Okay, great. Thanks. Thanks for coming. Nice to be with you again. And we're going to pick up our sort of series on Mark's Gospel. I must admit, this afternoon I struggled to remember quite where we'd got to and what we'd done, exactly how many chapters. I know we'd done at least four, but I couldn't remember if we'd moved on further. If anyone actually knows and wants to tell me, that might be useful. But I'm going to have to start where I plan to start anyway. But can anyone remember where we actually finished last time? How much we did? It was just the opening of, but I don't know how many
No,
chapters.
but you gave us homework to read chapter 6 to 10.
Oh,
But
right. But
we
it
finished
sounds.
on 5, verses 28 and 29.
Yeah, I think we did look into chapter five. Anyway, I want to go back a little bit. It doesn't matter if we overlap and don't get on as far this time, because we've still got the rest of the month to look at this. So I'm going to go back to chapter four at the end and verse 35, which is the calming or the stilling of the storm. So there's a short passage there at the end of chapter four, just half a dozen verses. But I thought what we'd do with this, as we stop and dig into this bit a bit more, is actually compare it with Matthew and Luke, just for once. Not always doing a full sort of synoptic comparison, but in this case we would. So if you can put your fingers in Matthew chapter 8 and verse 23 to 27. And it's also in Luke chapter 8, verses 22 to 25. So you'll find mainly similar, but maybe there's one or two differences. So for a couple of minutes, and that's all it really needs, why not read it in the three different Gospels and get ready to sort of comment upon what's in Mark plus what elsewhere. So as well as Mark 4, 35 onwards, it's from Matthew 8, 23 onwards, and Luke 8, 22 onwards. So just a couple of minutes to find those, read them through together, and then we'll discuss what it says in a bit more detail. So if you keep Mark particularly open, but if you want to look back at the others, keep your fingers in those as well. Remember, one of the reasons we're doing Mark is because his gospel is, well, it's the shortest, it's the most dramatic, it's the most vivid in many ways, and he uses a lot of miracles. So this is one of many different miracles, and it's a particularly vivid account of this with a particular purpose. And the purpose really is the way it ends with this tremendous question: who is this? So miracles are there in order to point us more specifically towards Jesus and ask that question and come up with an answer based upon what we've seen him do. This is a miracle which has been classified under a rather grand title by someone, I don't know who, but it's one of the miracles of dominion over the inorganic. Wonderful phrase. Miracle of dominion over the inorganic, which also covers other miracles. C.S. Lewis classifies miracles as those of the old creation and those of the new creation, by which he means in the old creation, Jesus just did in a more dramatic form what happens anyway. In other words, storms are stilled, they do quieten down eventually, and you could say that it's God behind it. God actually does it, but he doesn't usually do it in this particular way. So this would classify as a miracle of the old creation. Miracles of the new creation are things that really relate to something completely new that's yet to come. So, for instance, obviously the dead being raised to life, and things like the resurrection and so on. And also, say the walking, Jesus walking on the water, because that's something that doesn't normally happen at all. So it's in a slightly different category. So it's one of the creation miracles because it deals with nature, part of God's world. But it's the fact that this happens in a rather dramatic and unusual way in order to speak to us and to generate faith based upon the question, so this is who Jesus is then. So the way this one opens is it says that day when evening came. I don't think the other Gospels specifically say anything about the timing from that point of view. Matthew just simply says, then he got into his boat and off he went. Doesn't give much background. I think Luke probably gives you some kind of time indication, one day. But what we learn in Mark is that it's the end of a day, an evening. Do you think that's particularly significant? Is it helpful to know that it was in an evening? Any thoughts on that?
Was it getting dark so it was less easy to see the storm coming?
Well, there would be dark or getting dark. Yes, that's a good point. I mean, evening for us tends to mean when it's got dark, but as we know, it gets dark around 6 p.m. there. So it does make sense that it would be that. Yeah, well, that might be part of it. John, Rose?
Yeah. Way back in 1982, the first time I visited Israel, my friend and I stayed in the YMCA that's kind of half in the water right there at the southern end of the Kinneret. And the man who ran it said, those storms are a regular thing. They only come at night. They're fierce and they're sudden. And he and his wife living there just found it very interesting that this still happens. These fierce storms come up very suddenly at night.
Did he explain why, though?
Oh, no. I'm sure he had no idea.
Oh, okay. Well, perhaps I can enlighten him then. I mean, when I was there, I think I've crossed the lake a couple of times as part of my journey. On one occasion, it did suddenly get a bit choppy. I'm not saying it was as bad as this. But what's the geography like in the area then? Obviously, you've got the lake. But what surrounds the lake?
Yeah, comes down from the hills.
Yeah, the hills. And what happens in the evening?
It gets cool.
Yeah, and therefore the temperature drops.
Geography.
So very, very windy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happens is that the temperature drops, the air moves in some way, and it's funneled almost onto the surface of the lake. And therefore, depending on what the day has been like, but if it's been hot and then suddenly it cools dramatically and there's an airflow situation happening, that can disturb the water. In this case, it was much more than just a little disturbance. So perhaps there was a bit more going on to it. But we noticed it was a great storm of wind. In other words, the storm wasn't like we think of with rain and hail and things like that. It was, one version says, a squall. So it was a churning up based upon the wind upon the surface. John?
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
had a bit of problem. We've both been there at the same time at one stage, and at that time mentioned, and the storm, but the way the sort of the way you've got the funnel that goes down through the Galilee, and the thing is, the storm started just like that, and it was just so violent. It's quite dramatic. So we've been there when it was described there.
I suppose you've got Mount Hermon, which is very cold at the top there, and then you're going down towards down that valley, which gets hotter and hotter as you go in the valley.
Exactly.
Dropping of the cold air, the raising of the hot air, certainly get up. And this would have been the water, the wind. The wind's very strong.
So that explains the evening bit of it. I think it's another feature about another point we can make about the fact that it was evening based upon what else actually happened. Any other comment about the fact that it was the evening and therefore
Jesus fell asleep?
It looks like it was the end of a very busy day. If Mark is saying that day when evening came, then Jesus would naturally be very tired, and it wouldn't be a surprise that he actually fell asleep on that. But he's the one that actually says, let us go over to the other side. He's the one that's saying, we're going to go, which means to the east. The other side is on the east. So they're going west to east. So in the lateness of the hour and so on. The phrase to go over isn't usually used within the context of going across water. It's more about land, or let us pass through, which is what you'd do if you were passing through an area, a territory. But in this case, it's referring to the water. And verse 36, again, keep comparing it with Matthew and Luke if you want, because I'm not turning to it all the time. But if you've got something to comment on that, please do. But in verse 36 in Mark, it says, just as he was. They took him along just as he was. What do you think that's sort of saying? Is there anything to sort of dig out of that little phrase there?
Yeah, he was already in the boat because he'd been preaching from the boat.
Ah, right. Where do you get that from then? Go on.
One New Man Bible.
No, okay. But you mean there's a note to that effect?
Yeah.
Okay. But it goes back to the beginning of the chapter.
No, it refers to Matthew 13:2.
Well, okay, but it's also there in Mark 4.
Right, yeah.
Verse 1, okay? Yeah. Because the parables that he's just been saying, or the teaching he's just been doing, generally, this was the occasion when he got into a boat and sat on it, just on the water's edge, while the people were on the shore and so on. So he was already in the boat, and they took him along in the boat. That's why they didn't have to suddenly get a boat or find it or something. He was already there in the boat.
It's interesting to note that Jewish speakers always sit down. Oh, sorry, preachers always sit down to preach.
Yeah.
He was sitting in the boat.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, just to be a little bit here, I've got another book on the way on listening to the Jewish Jesus, which you might know the talk's on the website. So I've already been discussing a cover for that book. And the one that I've been most sort of attracted to, the ones offered, is of Jesus in a boat on the lake, facing us with the crowd there listening to him. Which would fit in very well with the theme. The only trouble is that, of course, he's standing in the boat. He's not sitting, because most pictures, most diagrams or drawings of him like that ignore that little detail of him being sat and having sort of standing up. So I might have to get rid of a bit of, get around a bit of authenticity there if I'm going to have a decent cover. But you never know. They might be able to tweak it.
Just sit him down.
Yeah, just put him sitting down. I mean, the reason I like the image of it is that it's a nice light, bright scene with the sky above and then the sea and then the people in front. So I think it makes a nice cover. And of course, I can't guarantee the boats looks exactly like they had then anyway. So sometimes you just have to put up with the picture side of it.
But having him sitting down is the Jewish Jesus, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's
so
the title.
It would be preferable, but I'll see what they can do on that.
Yeah, you don't want to be standing in a small boat anyway, particularly for a long period. Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah, thank you. Anyway, there's another little detail there in verse 36. Again, tell me if you find it in Matthew or Luke. But did you notice that there were also other boats with him? Other boats with him. I think maybe in... you might have other translations that help this. It talks about them being little boats or little ships or something. There were also other little boats. The boat he was in wouldn't be that big necessarily. But I suppose there would be other little boats around, because it was on the edge of the lake. So you might expect that. So why it's mentioned, I don't know, because I don't think the other boats actually set out. But the other question, of course, is how many of the disciples do you think actually went with him in that? Because if all of them are going with him, that would have to be a biggish boat in order to cope with them all. So perhaps some of them decided they would also go over to the other side and use some other boats. I don't know whether that comes through in any of them. We had a hand up a moment ago. Was it John again? Yeah.
You just made the point about the numbers of folk.
Yeah. So it might be that if they were all little boats, because if you remember sort of about the fishing side of things, unless it was the really big boats where they took out the trawl net, or the one, it's called now, that not the cast net, not the trammel net, but the big one where you had to have several people put it out and so on, you wouldn't have that many people in a small fishing boat. In which case, then, other boats were caught up in this, even at the same time, even if they didn't have Jesus there. And then in all the versions, I'm sure it tells you that it was a furious squall and so on, or the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. You get a very dramatic description of what it was really like. in other words, the danger was real. And on those experienced fishermen, they would no doubt, as people have been saying, have experienced similar things before. This was probably one where, and if they were going across to the other side, we don't quite know, but maybe they were already halfway across. so they probably didn't have an option of, oh, quickly, let's get back again. They were perhaps caught out in the middle of the lake at this particular time. Malcolm?
I find it interesting that Jesus was asleep on a cushion in the stern. I mean, there is no covered parts there, so he would have had the waves washing over him. Why didn't he wake up?
Yeah, exactly. If the waves broke over the boat, you're quite right. Jesus himself would have got a bit of a dousing down that. Yeah. Interesting little detail about the cushion there, isn't there? I don't know quite. It's obviously, that's a modern word for what we know of as a cushion, but there must have been something similar to that which was there normally, and he took advantage of that to lie down and put his head on it and so on. And then the bit, it really astonishes me, the next bit. So the disciples actually wake him. The storm doesn't wake him. The disciples wake him, and they ask him a question which I can only guess really is based upon their fear at this point and the sense of danger that they're in. Because they say to Jesus, they call him teacher, but they say basically, don't you care? That's an extraordinary thing to say to Jesus, don't you care if we drown? But that's the way they wake him up and give him that question. It's quite interesting, isn't it? But that's the first thing they really say. It must have come out of their anxiety about the whole thing. John again?
Going back a tad.
Yeah.
If he's going from west to east, then it's the wind that comes down through the horns of hit him and right. Down via Magdala, over Magdala and Gerizim, and then and comes across. And Rose said, well, maybe he was actually sitting on the cushion to do his preaching.
That's probably why.
As you'd said, they took him as he was. Maybe he was already reclining on the cushion he had been sitting on. I thought that was an odd remark to say, took him as he was. Like he didn't have time to go back for his toothbrush, or what did that mean?
Well, yes. I wonder if it's just one of these Mark's way of expecting things, like straight away, immediately. They didn't stop and do something else. But it makes me wonder now, if you're right, that he had already fallen asleep at this point, and they still decided, well, he's fallen asleep, but he said we better go across, so let's go. Because at some point they would have to go into the boat as well. I don't think they were in the boat when he was doing the teaching. So when he says to disciples, let us go over, and you can almost imagine some of them thinking, oh, come on, we've had a long day and it's a bit late and we're a bit tired as well. Do we really have to do this? Why are we going over to the other side, particularly this time of day? And we know there might be choppy waters. Very easy for them to have said, really, do you think so? Perhaps not. But of course they did it. But maybe Jesus was already asleep on the cushion, so they just got on with it. So, yeah. So they wake him. Don't you care? I wonder if we ever approach God in that sort of way, perhaps without really meaning it too much, but it just comes out of our anxieties and where we're at in life. We sort of want to say to God, don't you care about this in some way? John again?
Yeah, sorry. It's just as you were saying, if they just set off and they didn't have time to do other things, why? And this don't you care business is perhaps, well, didn't you know that it's going to blow up a storm anyway?
Yeah.
And that's why their reaction is don't you care that we're drowning?
Yeah.
So the two might be married together. I don't know.
Yeah. But
I think what a deep sleep he was in.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, exactly. They had to wake him from that point of view. And I mean, people, when they preach on this, would ever make a lot of it that Jesus was a perfect peace. He was trusting God. He knew they wouldn't drown. I mean, if Jesus says, let us go over to the other side, you're not going to end up at the bottom of the lake halfway through. That's a good sort of gospel preaching message to come out of it. If you've obeyed Jesus' instructions to go across to the other side, he's going to get you there somehow. But it might be a bit dangerous and fraught with anxiety on the way. But, you know, this adds to the reality of the situation and the human nature of it. Because in the end, if we're heading towards who then is this, or as my old version used to say, what manner of man is this? The comparison is with the manner of men that we are. He's different. He's very different in so many ways. And this is all coming through. So when he does wake up, at least for once, he doesn't say to them, at least not at this point, he doesn't say to them, oh, you know, what are you getting on about? And you've got no faith and so on. He deals with the situation first and then he talks to them. So he gets up and the first thing he does is he talks to the wind and the waves. It says he rebukes them. Any thoughts on that? Have you heard anything about the words that he used and what's actually going on at this point? Anyone got anything that might?
I always thought it was Jesus saying, oh, shut up and calm down.
Well, it is a bit like that, yeah.
Well, someone said the translation is more like the Scottish, wished. Shushed.
Okay. Okay.
But then he turns on the disciples and rebukes them much harsher.
Right.
Because he'd said they were going to the other side, so they were going there.
Exactly, yeah. But he deals with that.
Of course, they needed to land safe for Legion's sake.
Well, yes, indeed. And for the rest of the gospel story, because we didn't really want the disciples and Jesus ending up in the bottom of the lake in only chapter 4, do we? That wouldn't work. But has anyone else got any thoughts on actually what Jesus said and so on? I've heard it expressed in another way or two. Yes, John?
Well, in Genesis, he says, let there be light and, you know, let this happen and let that happen. So why wouldn't the same man say, be quiet?
Okay, so in other words, you're saying he was talking with the same authority as God did when creation was brought into being. So he's simply reminding creation who's in charge, something like that. You know, okay, that's a good point. Malcolm again?
Perhaps quietly.
Oh, sorry.
It don't matter, but someone, please.
Perhaps he spoke quietly. I mean, I know that all these sort of prosperity, these people, these healing preachers yell and bawl and shout and all the rest of it, but perhaps he doesn't. Perhaps he didn't. Perhaps he just said, just calm it. Just be quiet and get on with it, you know.
Okay. I'm going to say something a bit different in a minute, but Malcolm, you got your hand up?
Yeah. In verse 41, which is after Jesus had quieted the storm and it was a dead calm, they were terrified.
Yeah. We'll come to that in a minute.
What were they terrified of?
Yeah, I will come to that in a minute. But we're still working on the what Jesus actually said and so on. Pat?
I've got the Amplified, and what he says is at verse 39, and he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, hush now, be still, muzzled. And the wind ceased, sank to rest as if exhausted by its beating. And there was immediately a great calm, a perfect peacefulness.
Yeah. I think the word rebuked there suggests that he was being quite firm and loud in what he was saying, or the way he was putting it, very sort of clear and firm about it. But you use the word muzzled, which is right, because it's almost like, well, Christine can come in here, but what do you do when the dog is really annoying you and snapping at your heels and disturbing you? You tell it to be quiet in firm ways, not when it ever does so.
In firm ways, but it doesn't work.
It doesn't always work. No. Okay.
Tomorrow we're going for the silent treatment.
Okay. But the idea of it being muzzled is that it's like some angry creature that's disturbing them, and he is muzzling it. He is really shutting it down. And the fact that he rebuked it is a little bit, what else does he rebuke? At times he rebukes the evil spirits, doesn't he? And issues instructions like come out of him and so on. Because we're going to see that in the Legion story in a minute. But so he is commanding, he is being strong in what he's saying, and he's treating it like some kind of enemy or opposition to their purpose, which is to cross to the other side. And so on. Now, I'm not going to say he's seeing it as demonic or inspired by the devil to try and kill him and so on, but he is dealing with it in a very firm way. And it says immediately, or certainly, I think straight away, the wind dies down, it's completely calm, which does happen. But in this case, it happened in response to what Jesus said. And then he gives them the lesson that they need. Why are you so afraid? Well, I mean, it is obvious. They were in danger. They're bound to be afraid. Do you still have no faith? Well, we have a bit of faith. We're sort of getting there, but this was tricky. And so then, yeah, they were terrified. I mean, what were they then terrified of? They're terrified, if we use that word, of what had just happened and what they'd seen Jesus do, because this is the first time they'd seen him do something as dramatic as that, in this way, which I called earlier, sort of dominion over the inorganic. He'd done healings, I'm sure, before, but it's still fairly early on in the ministry. And this is the first time they'd seen anything quite like that. So the purpose of it was to make them more, should we call it, fearful, but in an awesome sort of way, and to ask the question. It's not just, who is this? It's, who is this that the wind and the waves obey? That's quite a significant question. They would never have thought of asking that. Jesus has to put them through experiences to make them think in the right way, ask the right questions, and change their thinking in various ways. So although I'm not saying that Jesus planned it like that, he, as always, took advantage of any situation that came along in order to teach them more, to show them more about faith, what it really means, and so on. But they had witnessed something so phenomenal that it made them wonder in a new way who this person really was that they were with. And it would therefore be a great step forward to them in that revelation that he was slowly enabling them to come to. So unless anyone's found anything in Matthew and Luke that's worth adding to what we've done, we will move on from there in a moment.
Matthew has in command talking to the disciples before he calmed the storm, verse 26.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Just tell me again, which one is that, Matthew or Luke?
Yeah.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? You're right. It is the other way around. Yeah. Yeah. And this time it says that they were amazed rather than terrified, but they asked the same question. That's a good point. What does Luke have then? Which way round is it in Luke? So in Luke chapter 8, it's back to the Mark way round, that he rebukes the wind and then asks them this. It's always interesting, isn't it, how you get these little variations, and there's nothing really you can say why or that it's better one way round or the other. Thanks for spotting that. So we have already, I think, looked at chapter 5 anyway. Now you've reminded me of where we really got to. So we're looking ahead into chapter 6 onwards, and we'll see how far we get. There is one point to make from chapter 5, which I don't know if I brought it out before, but one of the things that Mark likes to do in his storytelling, or his compilation of this, is that he does like to sandwich one event in the middle of something else. So, as I'm sure you know, that he deals with the Jairus' daughter issue. And while he's doing that, in the middle of that, there's another, literally an issue of blood, of the woman. So we start with one story with the synagogue leader coming and saying, please come and heal my daughter. And he gets going on that. And then we break from that for this other story of the woman who needs healing. And then once that's finished, you pick up the original story. So you've had a sort of sandwich effect, really, of one thing in the middle of something else. And that will occur a few more times if you can want to keep your eyes open for that. So in chapter 6, then, so in chapter 5, we've gone past the, why you went across the lake and what actually happened. And I know we did discuss this last time about the pigs and so on down there. So in chapter 6, though, he now goes back to his hometown, and we have an incident where he teaches in the synagogue on the Sabbath. And again, he's back to the healing things. But what we get in this first section is a reference to miracles that he couldn't do so many. He still healed a few people, but there was a lack of faith which was holding up, if you like, his having just experienced the faith of Jairus and the woman who needed healing. He goes to his hometown, almost like by contrast, and there people are questioning him out of a lack of faith. Who is it? They're saying, who is he? But they're coming to the conclusion, well, he's just a carpenter. He's just Mary's son. He's just Joseph's lad. He's got his brothers. They're here as well. We know who he is. We don't need to ask the question, who is he? And based upon that, Jesus comments that this famous phrase about a prophet's not without honor except in his own town and his own family, if you like. And he couldn't do any miracles there, except heal a few people. But if the idea of miracles are mighty works of demonstration of who he was, it seems as though he was hindered by the lack of faith there. Anyone got any comments on the first bit of chapter 6?
Just as it says, he is the carpenter, not the carpenter's son. So
yeah.
Obviously was skilled. They recognize his skill.
Yes, indeed. Because, of course, at this point, his actual father, Joseph, supposed father, Joseph, would have died by then anyway. So, they're classifying him according to what they can cope with, which is his, I feel like, his natural life, his natural abilities and so on. Malcolm?
Isn't the word there that's translated carpenter, isn't it the word tecton?
Yeah, yeah.
Which means a worker in wood and stone.
Yes, it's far more than we just think of as someone who bangs nails into a bit of wood. I'm sure it's more skilled than that, but you know what I mean. Yes, tecton means that he was generally in the building trade, if you like, and would be able to do all those different things. So, yeah, it is. It's one of those little things that we've got classified under one word when, in fact, it's a much more multi-dimensional thing. So, but I think Mark gives us this contrast. As always, you're trying to think, how is he progressing the story? Again, the issue is faith and who Jesus is. It's the same sort of question, it's the same sort of thing. And it shows that basically, like, Jesus didn't always have it with everybody saying, oh, how wonderful, this is who he is, and so on. He was at this, well, here, he's amazed. It ends with, this time, not the disciples being amazed, but he was amazed at their lack of faith. So, you know, it's interesting sometimes what Jesus had to go through. We don't think of him as sort of having to experience various emotions like this, but he was amazed at their lack of faith. Anyway, he goes then around teaching around the other villages. And now we get to the first occasion, certainly in Mark, where the 12 disciples become apostles. They're now being sent out to do what eventually all disciples were meant to do, which was to do what their master had been doing, which was to teach, preach, and heal in this particular way. And in a very sort of short, understated way, they went out and they did it. They actually found that they could do, and they preached, people repented, they drove out demons, anointed people who were ill and healed them. So the ministry was spreading through his apostles. And eventually, although there's the interlude here about John the Baptist being beheaded, this is what I meant by sometimes Mark sort of puts things in a bit of a sandwich. So you've got the disciples being sent out in verses 7 to 12, and we pick that up in verse 30 with the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported him all that they had done. So that ties together with the earlier bit of the chapter. But in the meantime, we've got a totally different story of King Herod, which must have therefore sort of been happening at this time, probably while the disciples were out doing all these amazing things, which meant that Jesus was becoming well known because of this, and questioning and saying again, who then is this? Oh, it's John the Baptist. Oh, no, it can't be, and so on. But they're beginning to debate this. He is a prophet, he's like one of the prophets. And then we get the story of how John the Baptist had been killed by Herod. And then we come back to the apostles now gathering around Jesus and reporting back to him all that they had done and taught. And at this point, Jesus says, well, better now go and get some rest. Let's go away. Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place, get some rest. And so they went in a boat again, this time to a solitary place. But it doesn't last for long because Jesus is soon teaching again. Yes, Pat?
It's just in verse... sorry, I've lost it now. All right, it's verse 20, chapter 6, verse 20. I've got, for Herod had a reverential fear of John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and continually kept him safe under guard. When he heard John speak, he was much perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, I've got the word puzzled, which I think there's a footnote. I'll try and explain it a little bit. Yeah, I mean, as we know, Herod was sort of reluctant to get rid of him. He was almost just sort of hanging on to him for his own sake, but because of this incident with his daughter, or the daughter of Herodias, this is one of the few occasions in the Bible, you'll have to forgive me if you don't like this sort of thing, when a birthday is mentioned. So when people say our birthday is a good thing, I say there's three birthdays mentioned in the Bible, that's all, and they're all bad, or bad things happen on each occasion, and this is one. Now, I'm not trying to tell you not to have birthdays or not to go to birthday parties. I'm just pointing out there's no biblical justification for celebrating a birthday, but I'll leave you to work that one through. But it, if he hadn't had a birthday, if he hadn't given a banquet, if this hadn't happened, who knows what turned out instead. I'll leave you to find the other times when a birthday is mentioned and things go wrong. So. But let's get back to Jesus and the disciples, because the next thing we have is another miracle. How would you categorize this miracle? This is the 5,000, the first of two big feedings. Would you say this was another one of dominion over the inorganic? Is this another one of the old creation or the new creation? What's the purpose behind it? What are we meant to learn from it? We all know the story, but are we familiar enough with, if you like, the point of it within the gospel narrative as a whole? What do you make of this story of the feeding of the 5,000? Any comments on it at all? Do you want to say anything?
Well, other than he had compassion for them, and yeah, they were hungry.
Yeah,
okay. They would be thirsty too, perhaps, but they were hungry. That certainly the starting point of it.
Yeah, okay. So, John, the other John, and then Pat.
It was something that happened, extraordinarily unusual. I mean, I should imagine people were completely, I don't know about confused, but taken them in shocked wonderment, I would have thought, that this guy comes along and there's 5,000 of them there and they're all getting fed. Yeah. Presumably they ate well.
Yeah. I don't think we're told. One of the things I said about the gospel as a whole is it's about action and reaction. Action that Jesus does and reaction to it. I'm not sure that we learn the reaction as such, but you're quite right. You don't go home to bed and forget this day very easily. You would always be thinking about what actually happened if you were one of those 5,000. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to know how he did it. I mean, did he adopt them? I mean, 5,000 is a lot of people in one place at one time.
Okay. Well, we will dig into that a moment in some of the detail. We're never going to quite know because it is a miracle from that point of view, but we'll look at those details. Just see if Pat and Malcolm have got something extra to say first. Pat?
Well, he knew beforehand what he was going to do. He was teaching the disciples a lesson, really.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. As always, he's going to use it to teach them. When you say he knew what he was going to do, do you mean that generally, or is there a specific reason in this case?
I think there was a specific reason, but I can't remember offhand all the details now.
Okay, well, if you find something in the text, then come back on that. But Malcolm?
It's interesting that with this particular occasion of feeding the 5,000, it says 5,000 men.
Yeah.
But on the other one, when he fed 4,000, it was 4,000 plus women and children.
Yeah. Well, presumably it'd be 5,000 men plus women and children that aren't mentioned. But I'm not sure how many women and children would be around following him like that. But they only count the men. It's one of those situations again. You're quite right. But in the other one, it does add there were women and children. So we might have assumed that was the case here. Again, what time of day was it?
Late.
It was late again. So it had been another busy day. And this comes back to the point that they must by then have all been hungry and so on. It was a remote place. Well, where was it? It was just somewhere. Because they'd gone to this solitary place to get some rest and the quiet. But wherever he ends up, there's a large crowd. Then comes the compassion, because they're like a sheep without a shepherd. They're obviously following around because they're desperate in some way. And so he began teaching them many things, and we're not told what those are, but I would imagine it's the same sort of things that he was already teaching that we know about from other occasions, like, for instance, on the Sermon on the Mount. He would be going on teaching them the same sort of thing, basically the kingdom, about the kingdom and so on. But it's getting late, so the disciples decide they better step in and sort of tell him that that's enough for one day, or we better deal with the situation, because people need to go and buy themselves something to eat and send them into the villages. And then comes the crucial moment in verse 37, you give them something to eat. Now, just imagine that, you know, you've asked Jesus to do something, particularly something dramatic, because that something should happen in some way, and his response is, no, you do it. You give them something to eat. Again, he's really putting them on the spot. He's testing where they're at on this. And inevitably, they say, well, you know, we haven't got enough money for all this. How can we go and buy enough? And so on. This is where probably he knows what's going to happen at this point, because he wouldn't have said to them, you give them something to eat, if he didn't know how he was going to fulfill this, I think. So then we get, who has got the five loaves and two fishes? I think in some versions, is this the one where there's a little boy that's got some food with him? Or is that the other versions? But it's not much. And I don't know how they ask 5,000 people quickly enough, you know, whether they're able to shout or rush around, who's got any food? Who's got any food? But eventually they say, basically, we've got nothing very much. Five loaves, two fish. Any idea what kind of fish?
St. Peter's fish, I would think.
No, it wouldn't be in this case. That's one option, but that's not the sort of fish that you carry around in your...
The dried salted fish for which Migdal was famous?
Could well be. Basically, it's the smaller fish. I think it's in some cases it says, and two small fish. But the St. Peter's fish is very big. And then, I can't remember, there's the blini, which I think is sort of medium size. And then there's something that's sort of like sardine size. It's the best way I can think of describing it. So even the fish weren't up to much, if you like. And I don't suppose the loaves were great big, thick sliced stuff. They probably were just tiny little sort of bun type things. So it doesn't come to very much. And then basically Jesus is still going to say to them, you've got to give them something to eat. And they're going to do it. But obviously they have to do it in the Jesus way, if you like. So Jesus first tells them to sit them down in groups on the, fascinating detail, green grass. I mean, do we need to be told the grass is green? I don't know. But anyway, on the green grass.
Time of year, Paul.
I suppose, yeah, it would mean something like that. But it doesn't mean anything within the context of the miracle, I don't think. It's not significant from that point of view. But he does sit them down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Any thoughts on that? Why does he want them to group, and why two different sizes, and how precise are the numbers? Pat?
I just want to go back to verse 39. Okay. He says, then he commanded the people all to recline on the green grass by companies. And when it says that, when you're reclining, he's more or less hinting that he's going to feed them.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Did
they
recline
to eat?
Yeah, and it was sit down because I am going to feed you. Yeah, whatever, whether it's reclining or whatever. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Did you say in companies? Okay, so we just got groups, I think. But perhaps that answers a little bit what I'm saying. Why did he group them into hundreds and fifties? Was it in order to create, we might call, fellowship type situations, you know, people in company with other people? Don't know. Did another hand go up? Have I missed one?
Yeah, and I put it down because of the companies. But it was reminding me, as you were speaking, of how they organized folk in Moses's time. And his father-in-law organized. Yeah. So, you know, you got to get yourselves in tens and fifties and hundreds and thousands and so on. So it was mirroring that.
Yeah. Okay. And then comes the bit that Jesus does before the bit the disciples do. The disciples are going to feed the people because they are going to distribute it. And at this point, this is where it starts. But now, here's the mystery of it, here's the miracle of it. Jesus seems to keep breaking it and breaking it, gives to the disciples, and he doesn't obviously hand it all out in one go. It hasn't suddenly become a massive amount of food, like going boom, like that. It's as though every time he breaks it, there's more again. And he breaks it and gives it to one of the disciples, the other disciple. And the more he breaks it, it doesn't become less, if you like. I think that reminds me of, didn't that happen to, was it Elijah? Where he kept feeding the widow out of a pot that never really got empty. But before he breaks it, what can you tell me about what happens there? What does he do?
Gave thanks, made a baracha.
Yes, okay. I don't know if anybody actually knows in full the prayer he would use. I would struggle to get all the words sorted out. But anything from John and then Pat?
Baruch atah Adonai melech haolam borei pri hagafen, that one. Yeah,
thank you.
Certainly in my NASB, it has bless the food, but the food is in italics, so he did not bless the food.
Exactly. That's a good point to make. They shouldn't put it in at all, really. I mean, right. When you bless or give thanks, you're blessing God, aren't you? I think you've been taught that we don't bless the food. You bless the Father who's given you the food, and you gave thanks because he says he looked up to heaven. And of course, heaven refers to God in that sense. So basically, he is addressing this to God. He's giving thanks to God. And then he starts to break the loaves. He also divided the two fish. That must have been a very interesting thing to do. Breaking bread seems quite straightforward. How you divide up the fish. But those get multiplied at the same sort of time as well. I might have missed another hand. Has one gone up and down again? Can't tell. Anyway, basically, they distribute to the people and it keeps going and it keeps going and it keeps going in a way that we're never going to fully understand because, again, this is dominion over the inorganic, if you like. Or is it part of the old creation or the new? I mean, in the natural world, the way things grow and even fish sort of multiply naturally in the sea and that sort of thing, it's not totally new. It's just that it doesn't normally happen in this particular way. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, because it may have been a hot and sort of humid climate and it was coming into the evening and they might have been traveling or, you know, if he's been in the boat, have you ever been on a boat and if ever you've wiped your lips or something with a hand, it's salty. And I'm thinking, gosh, they're breaking up this fish with his fingers. Yeah. Was he deboning them at the same time? That would have, you know, hopefully, I don't know, the mother of the little kid, maybe she did that before she put it in his packed lunchbox. I don't know, but I was just trying to visualize that.
Yeah, I know. It's always fun to try and visualize on what it's really like. I mean, my question is, did Jesus wash his hands beforehand? But, he's going to get criticized by the Pharisees for his disciples not washing their hands beforehand. He didn't seem to mind about what they normally did. But at the end of a long, hot, sweaty day, if someone's handing you some food, you probably want to know if they've actually washed their hands beforehand.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're so hungry they didn't care. I don't know. Pat?
I just find it interesting that it's all to do with food and nothing to do with drink.
Yeah, good point, because they must have still been very thirsty. They only have fish and loaves, and so they that's all they use. And it must have taken a while to feed 5,000. It's already late. So by the time they've actually distributed the food amongst 5,000 people and ate it, we assume at this point then that's the end and they do sort of disappear and go home. Although we're going to find out immediately next what happens to Jesus and the disciples. But perhaps the moment that they're given their bit of food and they eat it, then they... It's not quite like it's like class dismissed, get up and off you all go then. They probably just began to disappear back home once they'd had their meal. Lisa first again, then John.
If they did drink, if it wasn't mentioned in the text, but they did drink, it made me think, well, what did they drink from as well? Because the mind baffles, but perhaps they just felt enough from eating the fish. I don't know, but as somebody else mentioned, it will be salty and you'd be very thirsty.
Well, they might have had water with them because for my trips to Israel, one of the things we were told repeatedly is beginning of every day, make sure you've got enough water with you. Yeah. So probably it was a natural thing that people, when they're out for the day, they always had some water with them. Yeah. So they didn't need the water, because they didn't have the food. Perhaps they had their own water. We've got John Rogers, then John and Rose.
Yes. But the lake there is not salt water.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want to, and the other question I want to know, what did they do with what are the leftovers? Where did they go?
Yeah.
Kind of charity.
Yeah. They picked up the 12 basketfuls and so on. And then the next thing is immediately they get into the boat and off they go again. Did they take these baskets with them? Or did they leave them? I mean, obviously nice that they were tidy and concerned about not littering the place and so on. But maybe they left them there for someone else to eat from. It's interesting, isn't it?
The birds.
Yes, maybe. John and Rose, then Jan.
Years ago, I'd learned that the Greek word used for baskets here, the 12 small baskets, is a small lunch basket. Later on, when they gather 7 baskets, they're great big laundry things. So he was just preparing a meal for them as they got in the boat. They could have their...
Oh, I see. Because
there were no food banks.
So, okay, pick up the leftovers, put it in your basket because you'll need it later in the day. So it's their doggy bags. Is that what you're trying to say?
They're doggy bags.
Right, okay. Jan?
I was going to ask where they got the baskets from.
Yeah, well, good question as to whether or not they were their own baskets. There's 12 of them and 12 baskets, or whether other people had got them and so on. Because he doesn't say, it's almost as though the only thing we need to know is that there was so much that in the end, there was a lot of broken pieces left. So everybody, it says they ate and were satisfied. And then to sort of back that up, you get, and there was lots of bits left over. It's like looking at a table at the end of a feast or something. You've been, everyone's had plenty, we're all satisfied, but there's always bits and pieces left on the table. So.
Made me think of fishing net baskets, like lobster baskets.
Yeah. Interesting, though, you said that the other baskets in the other one were bigger ones and so on. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to another miracle, which is back on the sea again. This time, I don't think there's a mention of any kind of storm. I mean, if this really is the same day and it was already late, well, it says later that night. Verse 47. So, you know, we're still not really having a time of rest, are they? They're getting on, moving on, and it's the same day. So anyway, he makes them go into the boat, that's right, and go on ahead of him while he dismisses the crowd. Okay, let's get that sorted out. That he tells them that they can go and they're to sail around the coast, I would imagine. But it's not going to cross the lake this time. It's probably going along the coast. And he goes up in a mountain to pray, and then we come to the middle of the night. That's right. Where, the wind gathered again for some reason, and this time they're in need again, and this time Jesus isn't with them, but he comes to them, and this time he doesn't sort of rebuke them. He just says, "Don't worry, it's me," and he gets into the boat. And this time he doesn't have to say anything, but the wind dies down. But again, the reaction, they're amazed. Surely by now they would be less amazed because of what they've seen, including the feeding, as well as the previous stilling of the storm. But they're still very much in a sort of learning phase, of which comes through being amazed and being put through amazing experiences, really. So... any thoughts on the end of the chapter, from verse 45 to the end?
51, did you say? We're completely astounded.
Yes, well, terrified again is one way of putting it, but yeah, it's better to perhaps not think of it in terms of terror, but yeah, astounded. Yeah. Again, they wouldn't have expected this. This is very, very unusual. So, Pat?
It's just that they were so busy feeding the 5,000 that they sort of neglected themselves. And I think that is the reason why he insisted they get into the boat and go.
Yeah.
He dismissed the people.
Yeah. With their 12 little lunch packs of all the leftovers. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's verse 52 for the talking about the disciples. They failed to consider or understand the teaching and meaning of the miracle of the loaves. In fact, yeah. Their hearts had grown callous, had become dull, and had lost the power of understanding.
So what do you think they should have understood about the loaves? What had they missed from that point of view?
Well, it was the second time he'd done the same thing.
I thought this was the first time. No, the 4,000 comes later. The later chapter. But they're still not, you're right, they're still not got it by then. So they had not understood about the loaves. Does it mean they're not understood what Jesus could do? Pat?
I've just got that, you know, the Jews don't bless their food before they get it because they say God has already blessed it. And when he talks about the giving thanks and things, you know, they haven't got a true appreciation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right, just throwing things on the floor. To me, it's that they're still only slowly really sorting out what's going on here. I just wonder whether it means there was a big lesson they meant to have understood or whether they were just not getting the whole thing at this point. But I don't know, it doesn't say anymore. John or Jan?
Does Jesus walk on water twice?
No, I don't think so. Do you mean later in Mark as well?
No, I mean in this passage, Peter doesn't walk towards him.
No, I would imagine it's the same event, and just for some reason that bit isn't mentioned here. But it does make you think, could it have happened twice? But I don't think so. It is unusual. If Mark's gospel is based upon Peter's account, why Peter hasn't said, make sure you include that bit in this, because I want people to know what happened. But
I think he'd have been embarrassed to have it mentioned.
Maybe. I mean, it's an interesting, if we were looking at it with Peter there, I would be saying that, why on earth did Peter get out the boat in the first place? What made him do that? Because that's the astonishing thing, not the fact that it went a bit wrong. The others never even got out the boat. So what was Peter actually trying to do at that point that the others weren't? Because actually, I think this speaks more highly of Peter than it does that he took his eyes off Jesus, his faith went and he started to sink and so on. So yes, there is the embarrassment of that side of it, but actually it's a very positive thing that Peter was basically saying that to Jesus, if you can do it, why can't I? Because I'm following you, and you're going to say things like, you can do what I'm doing. He's already been sent out to do what Jesus did. He's seen the miracles that Jesus done. They started to do them. He started to reproduce the life of his rabbi in himself, which is the whole point of discipleship. He was actually trying to emulate his master. If Jesus can do this, I can have a go. Of course, he didn't quite make it, but at least he was understanding from that point of view. But I say it's not in this particular account for some reason, unless it's a different walking.
Was it excitement to seeing Jesus?
Well, maybe.
Just excitement, so he got out like a child seeing daddy come home.
Yeah, if you like. Yeah, okay. So Malcolm and then Pat.
Yeah, in terms of getting out of the boat, I think that he was just so completely absorbed in Jesus.
Yeah,
he got out without thinking.
Yeah, exactly. He probably that, if you do stop to think, you wouldn't do it. But by not thinking, if Jesus is out there, then it must be okay somehow.
Going on to verse 52, it says in the Complete Jewish Bible, for they did not understand about the loaves. On the contrary, their hearts had been made stone-like.
Yeah, their hearts were hardened. Yeah, so again, I can't answer what they were meant to have understood that they didn't, because their hearts were hardened. And why it fits in with this point, because it says they were amazed that Jesus had got in the boat and the storm had calmed down. They were amazed because they had not understood about the loaves. So I bet I can't quite tie that up in some brilliant way. Pat?
I'm just going back to your earlier question, and it's to do with verse 50, because they said, you know, they saw him, these apostles saw him, they were agitated. He says, but immediately he talked with them and said, take heart, I am. Stop being alarmed and afraid. And it's the I am. It goes back to Exodus when Moses in the burning bush.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so when we have something like it is I, we really should think of it as an I am thing. Yeah. That some people make something out of verse 48 that he was about to pass them by. I can't think what they make of that. But there were occasions, obviously, when God, with the Israelites, he passed by and so on. I can't quite remember what we meant to get out of it. Was it that Jesus was actually going to ignore them? Was he going to walk straight past them? Was that his intention until they cried out and then he decided to do something? I can't remember what it was I've heard in the past about that. But another little phrase that's tucked away in there that we might puzzle over. Why was he about to pass them by and then the rest happened? So I think on to John and Rose and then Malcolm.
Was he perhaps so absorbed in his relationship with his father that he really didn't notice them? As an example to us, we should be so absorbed and with our relationship with our father and our time of prayer, we shouldn't be noticing what else is going on around us.
Well, true, but don't forget, he says early on, he saw the disciples straining at the oars and then he went out to them walking on the lake. So he actually is making a deliberate thing. But you notice that's just shortly before dawn. So they're in trouble from later that night. He sees the disciples struggling. But he doesn't say he immediately went out, but he just says shortly before dawn, then he went out to them. And I wonder whether, because they've been struggling and because of the wind and so on, they really weren't getting very far. You know, he'd send them ahead of him towards Bethsaida, but it's probably that they'd hardly made any progress on that journey because the wind, this time it says, was against them rather than churning up the waters. They weren't in danger of drowning this time, just that they weren't making any progress towards Bethsaida. And effectively, Jesus, who eventually said, you know, you're going on ahead of me, but I will catch you up. This is his way of catching them up. But he does say he saw them straining at the oars and then eventually set out, knowing where they were and what they were doing. It would still be not quite light, which is probably why they thought it was a ghost, whatever that might mean in their understanding of things, but they didn't recognise exactly what was going on at first. So, Malcolm?
In the Complete Jewish Bible, verses 47-48, when night came, the boat was out on the lake and he was by himself on land.
Yeah.
In 48, he saw that they were having difficulty rowing because the wind was against them.
Yeah.
So at around 4 o'clock in the morning, he came toward them walking on the lake. He meant to come alongside them.
Yeah.
Understand that.
So you're saying shortly before dawn was about 4 a.m. So he could see that they were struggling, but he waited until 4 a.m., shortly before dawn. So he goes out towards them, but it then says he was about to pass by them. But I can't remember from the top of my head, quite what you can make of that phrase. I've heard someone explain it and I can't remember.
That's why I said in the CJB, it says he meant to come alongside them.
Well, instead of pass them by, is that what you're saying? That the translation, instead of he was about to pass them by, is he meant to. I'm not following you, Malcolm.
Yeah, he meant to come alongside them.
So that's, in your version, that's the end of verse 48. You don't have about passing them by. You have a different translation.
It's okay. Completely opposite. In the New King James, it's like yours, the NIV, Paul. Yeah.
Okay,
he came to them walking.
I just think there is something in those phrases, and I'm sorry I can't remember, which helps explain it better, because it's expressed in that way because it relates to something else. But I don't have all my notes on everything in front of me. Sorry, Pat, one more thing on this, then we'll try and move on.
Well, I've got in verse 48, and he acted as if he meant to pass them by.
Ah.
And I don't know if it's got anything to do with verse 52, when he talks about their hearts have grown callous. Because when you think of that, then you're thinking right back to Pharaoh.
Yeah.
The hardening of the heart.
Yeah.
And Pharaoh's heart was hardened because of the choices that he made.
Yeah.
When it said God hardened his heart, what it really meant in a sense was that he knew beforehand the choices that he would have made.
Okay. But so if you just read again what you have in verse 48, because that was beginning to ring a faint bell.
Okay. And he acted as if he meant to pass.
That was it. Yeah. He wasn't intending to actually just walk past and ignore them. He was acting as though that was going to happen, and then it didn't. Perhaps that was intended to provoke a response. I still can't remember all the details, but that rings the bell that that's probably a better way of understanding that. Anyway, I want to move on a bit more. Chapter 7, perhaps we can just briefly cover that in sort of 10 minutes. You've got the scene changes completely now, so there is a sort of natural break from there, because we've got Pharisees who have come from Jerusalem, and they see his disciples eating with unwashed hands. So they start to question, challenge Jesus about this. Jesus quotes Isaiah to them, and basically saying, you prefer tradition over the word of God or the commands of God. So there's this debate between the Pharisees, the traditions of the time, and what Jesus is actually doing. And then eventually he's going to leave the place, and we'll look at the last bit in a minute. But in that first section, dealing with the Pharisees there, they ask quite sort of okay question that, you know, basically your disciples should be doing this way and they're not. What's the reason behind this? Okay, they obviously feel that Jesus is almost like leading them astray. So what the disciples did or didn't do would reflect upon the teacher. Jesus couldn't get away with it from that point of view. He could not possibly say, oh, they don't understand yet, they're doing their own thing. He would have to accept responsibility that if they are not doing this according to the tradition of the elders, it's because he has told them not to, or at least he hasn't told them that they should do something. So he would have to accept responsibility for that, which is fair enough. Malcolm, then Pat.
Two things. Jesus had just been breaking the bread and fish without washing his hands. And what Jesus was rebuking them here for is that they were trying to make their traditions above the word of God.
Yes, that's the main point on that. The breaking of the bread would have happened a long time earlier, and the Pharisees weren't there to see that. This is a general thing. Basically, because they've come specifically from Jerusalem and they see them eating food earlier. So it relates to an actual situation that they've observed now that they've come. But yeah, the key point is, and this is Jesus's criticism of them, you've let go of the commands of God in favor of human traditions. You prefer human traditions, which of course means the later Jewish teaching on things rather than the original teaching that God gave to Moses. Pat?
In nowhere does it say that Jesus didn't wash his hands.
No, but don't forget that the disciples would do what the rabbi did. That's the way that they were learnt. So if Jesus was not doing the same thing, he would have told them to do this. You see what I mean? Yes, I agree, it's implied, but it's natural within the whole rabbi discipleship thing. That, okay, I'm trying to let someone back in again.
I think it actually goes a bit further than what the commandments was, really, that they've just gone that bit further.
Yeah. So who have?
The Pharisees.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Jesus is going to basically say, you're criticizing me because of what the disciples aren't doing. It's actually far worse, because here's what you're doing or not doing. You have set aside, and he explains to them how they have set them aside. He uses this strange example to us of Korban, which is obviously a particular word, which is explained to us because Mark realizes we won't know what that means. But they had a way of effectively nullifying what God wanted by human traditions. And this was one way of doing it, that instead of helping their father or mother, basically, instead of if their father or mother was in need and they had the means of supporting them, they could not hand their money over to their mother and father by saying, no, it is devoted to God. This is specifically for God, because I'm holy and religious, and that's devoted in that way. It's Korban. So basically, you've got to continue to be in need. And that was just one example in which they basically managed to sidestep what God really wanted. And no doubt they'd made up other ways of doing it as well.
One thing that amazed me when we were in Israel was the two-handed cups I saw in a shop. And me being gormless, I said, what are these for? And the chap just picked one up.
Hello? You're muted.
Sorry. Like a baby cup, where the baby's got two handles.
Yeah.
And they just slosh it over one hand and then slosh it over the other hand. And that's ceremonially washing hands.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it didn't have to be soap and water. Water was just poured over hands. I don't know whether that was just a quick and easy way of doing it, which didn't quite fulfill the proper way of doing it. But it doesn't mean you've got to go to the wash basin and put some hot and cold water together and get some soap or something. But they did always pour water over that. But Jesus goes on to teach a few things from there. And then can we got time just to look at one bit? Okay, well, let's have John next and then we'll see.
Can you hear? Yeah. Well, if you go into places of sort of rest or whatever, hotels in Israel that are kosher, you'll find that all the sinks have these two-handled cups. So that's how they do it all the time.
On a chain.
On a chain. They don't make them, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just thought I'd mention. Thank you. Yeah. That's neat. Well, perhaps we'll finish at that point. I'll make a more careful note this time of where we got to. But in verse 24, Jesus is going to leave the place and go to Tyre. And presumably, if he's already in Galilee, that means he's heading a bit further north and over to the coast. And we're going to see what happens in the next bit. So I'll make a note that next time from 7:24, I need to move a little bit faster in the remaining three sessions, otherwise we won't finish the gospel, and also we won't end up where I particularly want to, like the gospel does, with spending quite a bit of time looking at the at the Passion Week, as you might call it, from chapter 11 onwards, where he enters Jerusalem for the last time. So there's quite a bit in that bit. I don't know whether we'll be able to cover to the end of chapter 10 next time. So we've got two more weeks from chapter 11 onwards. That would be my aim. But at the same time, it's nice to have so many different things being mentioned by so many people, and we'll learn that way as well. Right. OK. Should we stop the recording there?